From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In the first half hour, my guest is best-selling author and Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate, Justin Cronin. We'll talk about his massive new novel, The Passage, the biggest book of summer so far. The novel is about a band of people who attempt to survive in a small colony surrounded by vampires. Cronin will give a reading tonight at Prairie Lights in Iowa City. Then in the second half hour, Fort Dodge native Lisa Cole, who has been named the top collegiate female track and field athlete in the U.S. In this year's NCAA Track and Field Championships, Cole won both the 5,000 and 10,000 meter races. That's all coming up after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Before she became the girl from nowhere, the one who walked in, the first and last and only, who lived 1,000 years, she was just a little girl in Iowa named Amy, Amy Harper Belafonte. The opening lines of the biggest book this summer so far, The Passage. Yet it's set several years in the future. The novel is about a band of people who attempt to survive in a small colony surrounded by vampires. Comments and praise about the book have been overflowing the pages of the New York Times, Newsweek, and just about every other major media outlet as the next big thing in publishing. It's been sold already in 25 countries. It will be made into a film with Ridley Scott as the director. Its author, Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate Justin Cronin, will be reading from The Passage tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore in downtown Iowa City. Justin Cronin joins me this afternoon in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Justin, if I may, welcome to the program. Welcome to our studio.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
And it's only fitting that you have this apocalyptic book and you arrived in a nearly apocalyptic rainstorm.
You all do like your rain here, don't you?
Coming in from the eastern Iowa airport. Justin, you were born and raised in New England. How ever did you come up with the idea of putting a little girl from Iowa at the heart of your vampire?
Well, I loved living here. I had, before I moved here to go to the workshop in 1987, I'd lived mostly on the East Coast, but also Hawaii and California. And I, of course, had no expectations at all moving here to go to the workshop. I was here to go to the workshop. I wasn't here to live in Iowa. But I just fell in love with the place, and I stayed an extra couple of years. I did Ragbri 6 times. I worked for the Daily Iowan while I was here, which kind of got me in touch with at least Iowa City outside of the parameters of the workshop and the workshop experience. And I just loved it here. I thought it was the best town I'd ever lived in. So there's a little bit of Iowa actually in everything I write and all the books that I write. There's a sort of gentle Iowa joke in my second novel as well. And when it came time to kick off this book, with that first sentence and have a little girl born somewhere, I thought, I suppose I did this intuitively, not consciously, but you know, that's kind of where I became a writer, so why not have the little girl come from there?
Tell us about Amy. This is a girl born in your fictional work in Iowa to an unwed mother, a single mother.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Amy is the major character of the book and of two more books that will follow that are set in the same world.
We know now that she'll be in the second and third part of the trilogy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's the girl who will live 1,000 years. And when I wrote that sentence, and I actually wrote that sentence first in the book, which I almost never do. Usually I kind of write from different places in a book until the book kind of finally settles down, and then probably I'll start moving in some methodical way from front to back. But when I sat down to begin this story, I wrote that first sentence, and I knew right away what kind of story this was going to be because the sentence actually kind of goes from a very broad viewpoint, both spatially and temporally. A girl who lived 1,000 years. There's lots of proper nouns in that sentence, too. All those names, you know, the one who walked in, that's capital O-1. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, a girl with somebody with a mythological status in some future time because it's a time after her death, which is 1,000 years later. She was just a little girl in Iowa, so the sentence collapses to littleness, to smallness, to this tiny name, Amy, just 3 letters in Iowa, which I think probably has the best name of any state It has three vowels in it. It's wonderful.
These three, you know, I'm glad you say that because I'd like you to comment on that. It seems to me, and maybe it's just because I grew up in Iowa, live in Iowa, that these four letters, Iowa, pop up unusually frequently in literature, in films, in Hollywood scripts. Why do you think that is? The iconic nature of that word, this place.
You know, I'm going to sound like I work for the State Department of Tourism or something. First of all, I think it's just a great place, and a lot of artists come through here in one way or another. I mean, the university, you know, of course, has the Writers' Workshop, but I think artists come through the state, and it makes an impression. It's beautiful and it's surprising, which is what art is supposed to be, I think, beautiful and surprising. And it, frankly, it has a great name. I mean, if you're going to pay, Kansas just doesn't sound anywhere near as good. Nebraska has all these sort of hard sounds in it and way too many syllables for what it is. But Iowa has just a kind of clean purity on the page. And I think it's come, of course, to stand for something. I mean, for the middle of the middle of the middle of the middle. And if you say Wisconsin, you think north. If you think Kansas, you think flat. If you think Iowa, you think the middle. And so I think it's come to stand, I think, for that, for a kind of universal every place, maybe.
Award-winning author and Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin, my guest, live in the studio right now. Justin, I get the feeling this conversation is far too light, bright, and sunny for a vampire novel.
Yeah, probably that's true.
So we better turn 180 degrees. Have you set the scene for this book, The Passage, the first of this trilogy, 766 pages? I think I'm up to about page 200. It is grabbing me in a way that maybe a couple novels grab me a year. What's the premise so that those who don't know it might enjoy it?
I'll give you a sense of the premise and a sense of the setup. The premise is this. Let's suppose that all of the lore of vampires, all the legends, all the vampire movies, all the vampire books, all the old sort of vampire stuff, it seems to have been a story with all of its various business that's been around for ever and many different cultures of the world. And you can look at, for instance, the story of the Garden of Eden as a vampire story. It has all the material in it. Let's suppose that like most myths or legends, it actually has a basis in some human fact, and that human fact would be plausible and realistic and you know, not what the legend became over time. So the what if proposition sets up a situation which a scientist, a paleovirologist, and I confess I don't even know if that's a real profession. One of the things you could do as a novelist, you can just make up a whole career if you want to. But somebody who studies ancient viruses goes searching for what he believes to be a virus that is lodged somewhere in nature, which has occasionally crossed over into the human community to bestow upon people spectacularly long lives, right? Great physical robustness. And one would hope perhaps not too many unpleasant side effects. but of course that's what you get. So that's the what if. The setup for the book is this. It's actually a story before and after. I mean, the book's kind of, I don't want to say it's broken in half. It's like one third and two thirds. And the first third of this story is the before. And it's a series of events leading to an event that comes to be known as the Great Viral Cataclysm, about which I need say really nothing more. And then the story jumps actually 100 years into the future. There's a little bit of a pivot. But the main action of the story and of the books that will follow takes place 100 years later in a small mountain community, descendants of children who were evacuated from another place I lived, Philadelphia, in the last days of the war, who believe themselves perhaps to be the last remaining human beings alive on the North American continent. And they set off on a journey to the heart of what they believe to be where the epidemic and this catastrophe began, in the company of a young girl.
Amy, born in Iowa. Now, I understand this was all set in motion by your girl, then 8 years old.
Sure.
And now, what you described to me is I have a daughter as well. Not the typical thoughts of an 8-year-old. I imagine you added quite a bit to this.
She was extremely helpful. The novel actually came about because she dared me to write it. I mean, my daughter came to me in the fall of 2005 and expressed some concern that perhaps I was not living up to my full potential as a writer.
Had she been reading your work?
No. And, well, I asked her. She thought my other books might be boring. And I said, honey, did you read them? And of course, they're really not for an 8-year-old. And she said, no. And I said, well, how do you know they're boring? She said, well, I looked at the covers and I read what was on the back and not much seems to happen in those books. And I said, okay, fair enough. All right, I get your point. What do you think I should write about? And she suggested that I should write about a girl who saves the world. Those were her words. And that it should be interesting and that it should have one character with red hair. So you don't have to guess what
color. Does she have red hair?
Of course she does. Yeah, that one did not get made up whole cloth. And so I said, okay, fine. You know, I confess my heart sank a little bit because I was hoping maybe something smaller would more fit, like the girl who saves Connecticut. But you know, you're a parent, so you know how much you have to fake it. And I said, okay, fine, I'll do that, but you have to help me. And so for about 3 months, every day after school, I would take my run. I run every day after work. A habit I actually got into in Iowa City, where I cannot run this afternoon because it's raining. But every day after school, she'd get on her bike and she'd follow me around. And for about, you know, 6-8 miles, we'd go out for like an hour and change. And we played Let's Make a Novel together. I mean, it was really just a kind of dad and girl game. And we were just kind of passing the time. And what came out of this was essentially a solid outline for the novel as it stands. I mean, there was lots of details, things I changed, of course, and I had to write the thing and find its voice and all the things that you do when you actually start laying the brick of a book. But those 3 months, the basic outline, the premise, all of it, it was hammered into place by me and she turned 9, but a 9-year-old.
We have to take a short break in just a minute, but what was the moment during this jog with your daughter that you realized this is not just an exercise in parenting? This is something, I think you've called it your life's work.
Yeah. I think it was really very close to the end, actually. It was an evening, I was talking about it with my wife, and I realized it was just too good to leave alone. You know, I don't know where a great story comes from. They come from above, but this one was mine, and I couldn't walk away.
How long has it taken you to write it?
I really spent about 3 years, 3.5. I mean, I had to kind of shake loose from some other commitments. Like a lot of novels, there's a slow period at the start, and then finally you kind of clear out the clutter and you can just go. And so it was really about a 3-year book.
Award-winning author, Iowa Writers Workshop graduate Justin Cronin in the studio with me today. The Passage, his massive new novel. It's actually the first of a trilogy about a band of people attempting to survive in a small colony surrounded on all sides by vampires. And when we come back, more with Justin Cronin. I want to ask Justin when we come back why his vampires are not sexy and debonair like the vampires on TV in Twilight. Why did he pick these vile, foul-smelling, vicious creatures to inhabit his book and write from their perspective as well? That's when we return to talk with Justin Cronin. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
I'm a vampire, babe, sucking blood from the earth. I'm a vampire, babe, sucking blood from the earth. Well, I'm a vampire, babe, sell you 20 barrels worth.
And we're back with Justin Cronin on this edition of The Exchange. Coming up in just a few minutes, Fort Dodge native Lisa Cole. She's been named the top collegiate female track and field athlete in the U.S. In our second half hour, we'll talk to her live. Justin Cronin with us in the studio of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City. Let's talk about vampires, Justin. Invite perhaps a caller to 1-866-780-9100. Your questions for Justin Cronin about the coming vampire apocalypse.
Or vampocalypse, as I've heard it been called.
It's been shortened already.
Yeah. I wish I could take credit for that. I got that one on Twitter.
Your vampires, they are not these good-looking, sexy people that we have so much in literature and on TV and in film as of late. How did you come up with this particular vision of the classic bloodsucker?
Well, the thing about the vampire story is that it's really good soft clay, and you can kind of do what you want with it, and you have to also. I mean, the easiest answer to your question is because the handsome, debonair underwear model vampire has been done, you know? And if I was going to work within something that is, for all intents and purposes, an established tradition, you know, yeah. I just I wanted to do something that felt like me. Maybe I was in a bad mood
felt
that
like
day.
I'm remembering a description of when you describe these creatures for the first time. It's like skin stretched over coils.
Yeah.
Is that what you used as a description?
Yeah, I guess,
Tell us more about these creatures.
Well, what they are is an amalgamation of every detail that we associate with the traditional Gothic vampire, but it's been deprived of magic. So the Gothic story of the vampire is essentially a story about a magical creature. Somehow he is a vampire, you know, and he's lived forever, Alakazoo. And
no science.
Yeah, no science. But science has been absolutely the magic of my lifetime. I mean, since 1962, when I was born, you know, as a child of the space race, I thought for sure by now we'd all be living on Mars and dinner would be popping out of the wall like it does on the Jetsons. But so I'm a little disappointed. But I do have my iPhone, which seems to me a miracle on a par with all those things. You know, science has done things in my lifetime that I never could have imagined, and I feel like the story didn't need magic. And so if I backtracked the story of the vampire and took all of the details and gave them some kind of physical basis, that was my strategy. That was how I was going to own this story. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the idea that a vampire can only be killed by putting a stake in his heart, right, which is a sort of romantic statement mm-hmm. more than anything else. In fact, my vampires, and they're called vampires only very occasionally in the book.
In fact, the characters don't like to call them vampires.
No, they think that's a joke. Yeah,
and they don't get government grants for science when they call them vampires.
Yeah, the paleovirologist is in charge of the whole thing. So it's just try to get money from the NSA with vampire anywhere in the paperwork. Right?
Just try.
Yeah, just try it. Yeah. The virus that he finds actually works by reactivating the thymus gland, which is this sort of mysterious little thing.
Is that in your chest somewhere?
Yeah, it's in your chest. It's very conveniently located. If you were so staking the vampire in the chest became, in my narrative, shooting somebody in the thymus, right? Which I was introduced to the thymus gland actually by a friend of mine who's a writer. He's a poet and also an oncologist. And he was talking about a patient of his who had cancer of the thymus. And I said to him, what's the thymus? Because I knew of it only as sweetbreads, essentially, as a sort of bizarre culinary thing. And he explained it to me. And I said, what does it do? And he says, well, the truth is nobody really quite knows. I mean, it has something to do with the immune system. And all of a sudden, you know, my brain just sort of lit up because he was pointing right at the middle of his chest. And I thought, that's perfect. Like, a virus that does something to the thymus gland over time through storytelling, mm-hmm. through myth, through legend, becomes the vampire who needs a stake through his heart. So every detail that I worked with, I did something like this.
That makes the story, in my mind and many others, very, very believable. David is joining us from Iowa City. Good afternoon, David. We have just a few minutes left with Justin Cronin. What's your question?
Hi. By the way, the book sounds fascinating, and I hope you'll encourage the publisher to issue it in audiobook.
Oh, it is. It is. We have abridged and unabridged audio.
Excellent. It's impossible to listen to this description without summoning up Stephen King.
Sure.
I'm a big Stephen King fan, and I just wonder how much you found yourself influenced by Stephen King over the years.
Well, the real influence here is that Stephen King has been a tremendous help to me. He actually blurbed the book. We gave an early copy to him, and he actually said some really nice things about the book, which was really, really very touching and very helpful. And, you know, you write for the masters, too. You don't just write for the yourself or for the public. You really want to be blessed by other writers. And he's known as an extremely generous guy. Like everybody else, I've read plenty of Stephen King. I mean, the guy's more than a writer. He's a monument. I can't think of any writer who has as big a hold on the popular imagination as Stephen King. The book to which mine is compared a lot, which is enormously flattering, is The Stand. And as it happens, that's the book of his that I know the best.
One of his oldest books.
Yeah, it's kind of what I guess people who really sort of follow his work think of that as early Stephen King.
That's also a trilogy.
The Stand? No, there was just two editions. There was one that was the one that was released in the late 70s, and then there was a kind of director's cut that's a mammoth. It's huge. I don't know how many pages it is, like 1,300 or 1,400 pages. Right. So I actually haven't read that one because I read the original back in college. And that may be the first book of his I ever read, and that was the one that made – the greatest impression on me. I mean, what he's kind of a, he reminds me, he's sort of our Edgar Allan Poe in a lot of ways. I mean, he's the guy who takes the ordinary world and just turns it like 2 degrees to the right or left and suddenly makes it enormously disturbing. And I think that's his genius.
Let's talk a little bit before you have to go here. We've got a 2 or 3 minutes left. The way you shift from character to character in this book, and you give us all the perspectives of your characters. What's it like to inhabit a character as a writer? And most fascinating, perhaps, is what's it like to step into the skin of a vampire?
Well,
how do you do that?
Writing a character, I mean, to write a character to inhabit their point of view is probably why I do this. It's probably the reason I'm a writer, because there's something about it that, I don't know, just makes me feel like a better human being. I mean, it's empathy is what it's called. You know, I don't think I would have been able
something
to do.
Something you practice and get better and better at.
Yeah, you practice it as a writer and you practice it as a person too. I mean, I've always said that I don't think I would be a writer or a particularly good writer if I'd never been a parent, because parenting reminds me so much of what your relationship to your characters, oddly enough, because you have to learn to see the world through another person's eyes, and the stakes are very high. You know, when you're a parent, you really got to say, okay, I'm no longer just me anymore. I'm also her, and I'm him. I'm these other people at the same time over whom I have some control but not complete control.
Right.
And sometimes shepherding a character through a book feels very much like raising your child and then sending them off to college with your fingers crossed. You know, it's kind of raising them up. The range of characters in this book was real. I mean, this was what really kept me going. It's obviously a very long book. It was very hard. Writing any novel is hard work. This was hard work. But the thing I got to do is I got to take up the points of view of people who are not at all like me, and find out the ways in which we were the same. And that's always a kind of deeply satisfying experience.
How did your time, Justin Cronin, at the Iowa Writers' Workshop in the late 80s shape you as a writer? What did it give you?
For the most part, I think what it gave me was those first couple of years when I didn't have to think about anything else. And I think that's the real gift of the workshop, because the people who come here are typically young, although not always. I met many people who came in midlife or even late in their careers. But I got 2 years basically going to the church of writing every single day. And our culture doesn't really make it possible for artists to do that very often, unless you're like independently wealthy. You need an institution, you need a framework for that. And then the best thing about it all is you come here and everybody else is doing the same thing. It's like you found your new 100 best friends, and you feel supported and you feel ratified by it.
1 minute left, Justin Cronin. The Passage, your new book, the first of this trilogy, has been sold in 25 countries, and we've heard it will be made into a film. Film rights sold. Ridley Scott will be the director, it's said. How much input will you have on the screenplay and film, or is that all gone with the selling of the rights?
No. The contract is as fat as a Reuben sandwich, so I can't really describe all the details. But the truth is that I'm an asset that they want to use. The screenwriter is John Logan, who wrote Gladiator for Ridley Scott and The Aviator, so he's like a genius, and he's also a great playwright. So they need to know things about the later volumes in order to make this work. So that's been my role, is telling them those things.
You know, Iowa has a fledgling film industry. Do you think you could put in a good word and lobby for the parts with Amy, your heroine, as a young girl, to be actually filmed in Iowa?
Give me the number. I'll make the call.
Will you do that,
yeah,
Justin?
You bet. Anything for my Iowa.
Thank you. Justin Cronin for joining us, award-winning author, Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate, and you'll be reading tonight from The Passage at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. 7 o'clock start time?
7 o'clock.
Justin, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for making it through the rain, the epic rain, to talk about your epic work, The Passage.
Thanks for having me.
The Passage, Justin Cronin's new novel. When we come back on The Exchange, Fort Dodge native Lisa Cole, an epic runner. Everything's epic on our show today. She's been named the top collegiate female track and field athlete in the U.S. That's when we come back. Lisa Cole, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So glad to have you with us over the rainy noon hour. I think it's clearing up. My next guest is Lisa Cole. Lisa is a native of Fort Dodge and a senior long-distance runner at Iowa State University. and she's just won the Honda Sports Award in track and field. This designates her as the nation's top collegiate female athlete in the sport. Lisa is a 9-time All-American. She also holds the college records and the 6th fastest time by an American woman in the 10,000 meters. Lisa joins us live this afternoon by phone. Lisa, congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow, let's recall last week in this year's NCAA Track and Field Championships in Eugene, Oregon. You won both the 5,000 meters and the 10,000 meters. You captured your 4th NCAA title, and you finished the 5,000 30 seconds ahead of your nearest competitor before this roaring crowd of more than 11,000 fans. What a way to end your collegiate career.
Yeah, it was kind of picture perfect. One of those things where it ended up being sort of a storybook ending, and you don't get those very often. So,
what if someone had told you as a freshman or even in high school in Fort Dodge this would happen?
Oh, I wouldn't have believed it. I mean, I don't even think, like, I didn't even know that people ran professionally when I was in high school and even my first year of college. I didn't even know, like, people could do that. And so, I mean, I've come a long way. I've learned a lot about the sport, and I've just kind of taken small steps along the way. So,
For instance, what's the biggest thing you think you've taken a step in understanding about the sport?
I think I probably understand now more how important doing little things is, like getting the sleep that you need to get, going to the trainers every day, and just really paying attention to those small things because they add up over time.
Mm-hmm. The discipline, too.
Yeah, definitely.
Some people say, you know, I'm sure this is no secret to you, that there's no technical skill involved in running as the technical skills, and they're not as obvious as in other sports such as basketball or baseball. How do you respond to this, or do you even get this?
I understand. I mean, I guess there's not really a technical skill in distance running, but I think the time spent in distance running is equally as time-consuming. I mean, people would spend hours practicing on the basketball court shooting free throws, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I run at least 2 hours a day, plus with stretching and general strength stuff. I'm probably working out about 3 to 4 hours every day.
What did I read? Almost 100 miles a week you're running in the summer?
Yeah, I usually run 90 to 95 during the school year. So.
If you'd like to have a question or a comment for our long-distance runner, Lisa Cole, native of Fort Dodge, ISU runner, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPRTalk. Lisa, so tell us your racing strategy. What is your strategy? What is your approach to a big race, the 10,000 or the 5,000?
It depends on the race. I mean, if I'm trying to run a fast time, I'm definitely not afraid to go out front and lead it. And that's kind of what I did in the 5K. But if, for example, when I raced the 10K this weekend, I knew I had the 5K 2 days later, and so it was more tactical. And I just kind of...
What does that mean, more tactical?
Tactical means trying to conserve energy, so trying to win by the smallest margin possible. Mm-hmm. So I just relaxed and let other people lead for the first half of the race, and then kind of waited until there was about a mile and a half left in the race, and then made a move. And once I had a good, comfortable margin of distance, then relaxed the last mile or so, and just finished pretty relaxed and easy and didn't put too much effort into it.
Why is it stressful to be out in the front? If you're following someone, you're 5 or 10 meters behind them rather than out at the very front. What is that stress at the front? Can't you just get rid of that in your mind?
I mean, I think a lot of it is mental. It feels a lot easier to just be following someone. You don't have to think about pace. You don't have to really be concerned with anything that's going on. You can just kind of zone out. So mentally, it's easier to kind of give yourself a rest. But also, I mean, if there's any sort of wind, you're taking the wind, and everyone's staying behind you, and so they're going to be a lot more fresh the last, say, mile or so.
I knew that made a difference in cycling, but that makes a difference in running as well.
Yeah,
huh?
Definitely.
Hmm. So you want to be behind, you want to have someone else in the front with that wedge.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier. I mean, even people who try to run fast times, they'll hire what they call rabbits, and those are people that will run some portion of the race, the first half of the race probably usually, at a certain pace so you can just follow, and then you only have to do the last mile by yourself.
You also still run cross-country?
Yes.
Now describe the cross-country start, because I've heard some say it can be gruesome. In fact, one of our producers, Lindsay Moon, here described how when she was in high school as a cross-country runner, she tripped at the beginning, got trampled, got a spike in her calf.
Oh, yeah. Cross-country is rough. I mean, track can be rough, too. It's all about getting position. I think cross-country is more difficult because there are 100 to 200 people on the same start line. And usually the line's pretty wide, but sometimes the course is narrow really fast, and you have to get position really quickly.
Have you ever fallen at the start?
No, I've actually, knock on wood, I've never actually fallen to the ground on a start, but I have had, during a race when the pack got tight, someone step on the back of my shoe, and my shoe came off. And so that was not ideal.
Mm-hmm. When you're running around a track, I suppose, with cameras, a lot of observers, it's hard to do, shall we say, unethical things, but maybe on cross country, I'm thinking perhaps this is possible. Other sports have players who trash talk or employ unethical tactics. Does that ever happen in cross country?
It does. I've never had it happen to me, but and usually happens, not to stereotype, it usually happens more in men's races than women's races. They'll throw elbows or push or shove, but I've never had anything too physical happen to me during a race.
Mm-hmm. So how do you approach the different parts of the race? A little bit more detail from start to finish. What are you thinking to yourself at the beginning? And take us through a typical race. Pick a favorite type of race.
All right, probably a 10K. So like the 10K when I ran at Stanford, when I ran the collegiate record, the first 5K, I was just trying to hit. I was trying to hit a certain split for 400 meters. So my coach was at one point on the track, and he'd give me a split every lap, and I was just really focusing on those splits and keeping those consistent and staying really relaxed the first 5K.
Mm-hmm. And when you make those splits, if you didn't have that clock, could you feel the split?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty good at feeling pace. That's something that I think I have a pretty good talent for.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really a rhythm runner. Like, if I get into a rhythm, I can stay in it for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and then I like to do something called negative splitting. So the first half of my race is slower than the second half. For example, at that race, I think I ran my first 5K was 15:51, and my second 5K was 15:27. So after 5K, I just kind of picked it up a little bit lap by lap.
So you're just shaving off your splits as
yep.
you get to the second half of the race.
Yep. And I think for me, that really helps because I feel like I'm getting momentum
mm-hmm.
and I'm going in the right direction.
Are you thinking about your splits the whole time, or do your thoughts wander, or do you have some inspirational images or sounds?
I'm really, really focused on the race. I'm really focused on what's going on around me, how I'm feeling. Especially if the race is more tactical, I'm focusing on where my competitors are. I'm very focused when I race, and my mind doesn't really wander much anywhere else.
What about the people cheering in the stands or along the cross country route? Do you hear them?
I mean, I don't hear the only people I hear specifically are usually my parents and my coach. And I think it's just that I can tune into their voices, and so I hear them. But everything else is just kind of noise.
Let's talk a little bit more about preparation for your races, and let's reach out to our listeners to ask if you have questions or comments for long-distance runner Lisa Cole of Iowa State University, a native of Fort Dodge, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about long-distance running, about training, about the races. You can write us at The Exchange or email theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter, IPR Talk. So let's talk about preparation for your races of such long distances. You've already said you run almost in the summer, almost 100 miles a week.
Mm-hmm.
What about the physical or the mental training? How do you toughen yourself up mentally? Because isn't there, when you have 10,000K in front of you, isn't there, or 10,000 meters in front of you, isn't there some dread at the beginning that you've got a long stretch or not? Is it?
Actually, I think for me, there's less dread during a 10,000-meter race than a 5,000-meter race, just because I feel like I'm much more aerobically fit than I have speed. Like, I don't have a lot of turnover. But I have the aerobic capacity to really crank out mile after mile of a decent paced race. But I think the mental training of it comes into those hard workouts, workouts where you're on the track and you're like, oh, I can't do another repeat, but then you do one anyway. And mm-hmm. so when it gets hard in a race, you know, okay, I felt like this during a workout before and I finished, so I can do this.
What sort of runner were you in high school in Fort Dodge?
I was decent. I mean, I wasn't great. The highest I ever placed at state in high school was third, and in track, and then eighth in cross country. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't recruited out of state. I was only recruited by the Iowa schools.
Okay, so the obvious question here, Lisa, you say you self-describe yourself as a decent runner at Fort Dodge High School. Now you are designated as the nation's top collegiate female athlete in long-distance running. What happened?
Yeah, everyone always asks that, and I really don't think there's a secret formula or anything specific that I did. I mean, I think it's just year after year of hard work and not giving up when things got tough. And I mean, there are plenty of times I struggled and plenty of times where things went well. And I think I just kind of took it day by day. And as long as I was setting PRs, as long as I was progressing in my running, I was happy. It wasn't like, okay, I need to go out and I need to win Big 12s this year. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, at some point during this year, I'd like to run faster than I ran last year.
When was the moment you recognized you were world class in this sport?
I think 2 years ago when I ran 32:11 at Stanford for 10K. It was the new American collegiate record. And that was kind of the eye-opening day for me where I was like, okay, wow, maybe this is something that I can do in the future.
Mm-hmm. May I ask how tall you are?
I'm 5'4".
5'4". Is there something about your body structure, your physiology, that makes you ideal for these distances?
I don't really think so. I mean, distance runners come in all different shapes and sizes, and there are some girls that are taller than me or shorter than me or thinner than me or more muscular, and mm-hmm. I think it's all about just finding what works for you and
Because I was reminded of sort of Michael Phelps during the Olympics, these huge hands and so forth. He just looks a little bit strange, but in a good way, in a fast swimming way, right?
Yeah.
Let's go to our callers, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Algona. Is it Beanie?
Yeah, that's right.
Hi, Beanie. Welcome to our program.
Hey, thank you. Hi, Lisa. My wife and I are both runners in Algona, which you're familiar with, and we both graduated from Iowa State. She ran in the late 90s, and we're just thrilled at your success. It was so exciting.
Thank you.
And my question is, there's a letter to the editor in today's Register. I don't know if you've seen it. That it's from a professor at Iowa State just proclaiming your intelligence in the classroom. And so I guess my question is, what's next? Are you going to run pro, or are you going to go with vet school, or is it vet or running?
Yeah, it's definitely a decision that I've contemplated a lot over the past year. But I think I'm going to probably take some time off from vet school and pursue running. The first 2 years of vet school are really academic, and so I've been able to balance them. And the faculty at the vet school has been amazing in supporting me. But your third year and fourth year is when you start doing surgery and rotations, and it's just going to be impossible to do both to the 100% dedication that I want to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm going to take some time off from vet school and pursue running and then come back when that avenue has kind of not become an option anymore.
Well, in that case, best of luck running, and we both hope you stay healthy, and when someday you're done running, you can fix our animal.
All right, sounds great. Thanks.
Beanie, congratulations.
Thank you.
Beanie, thank you for calling from Algona. Is there any sort of connection you see in your studying veterinary medicine between what you're doing with your body and how you're helping heal animals?
Yeah, I think I've always been very interested in anatomy, in biology, that sort of realm, medicine. So I think they kind of interrelate. I mean, when you think about a lot of like muscles that you can strain when you're running, or injuries that I've had, and then we go and go to anatomy class and learn all about what Achilles tendon and what tendons all make that up. I think it's relatable.
Mm-hmm. You have suffered a decent number of injuries, I believe, in your career.
Yes.
Now, what injuries most worry you?
Probably plantar fasciitis was a big one that I struggled with.
This happens in the sort of the sole of your foot, doesn't it?
Yep, on the inside heel of your foot. It's where the tendon kind of starts pulling off from the bone in your heel, your calcaneus, and it's pretty painful and pretty long term. I think I struggled with it for almost a year. There were points when I could run through it, but I didn't feel very good. So
how do you guard against that? Some stretching or?
Yeah, lots of stretching, rolling your foot out on like a pop bottle, like a frozen pop bottle. Yep.
Now, do your parents run? Do you come from a family of runners?
My dad went through a phase where he ran a lot. He did a lot of road racing. But other than, he didn't really do that until I was maybe in middle school. And he doesn't run anymore. So no one that really ran a lot in college or anything.
Let's go to Brandon, who is on the road. Hi, Brandon.
Yes, hello. I'm really enjoying the interview. I've been driving from Tucson to Madison, Wisconsin over the last 2 days, flipping through AM stations. Really enjoy the interview.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
My question is that I imagine that watching your diet is part of your training regimen. I'm curious if your diet changes as you approach race day and if there are any restrictions that you're on, and also if you take any protein or energy supplements.
Brandon, thank you. Yeah. Tell us about your diet there.
Yeah. Actually, I'm a big proponent of I eat what my body's craving. I try to get a lot of variety, but I'm not real specific. I don't really pay too much attention to it. I just try to get a good variety, and I eat when I'm hungry, and I don't eat when I'm not hungry.
Do you have a specific pre-race meal?
But yes, I before I race, I try to be done eating about 4 hours before I race, but I usually eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are like my staple in my diet. And so that's something that I usually eat on race day for lunch if we race in the evening, because it's pretty simple, it digests easy, and it's what I've done for the past probably 2 years. And so just something that I've really stuck with and been consistent with.
Mm-hmm. You pay attention to what your cravings are. What is the biggest craving? What food do you get the biggest craving for?
Probably either peanut butter or chocolate.
Peanut butter
or
chocolate.
Those are the two biggest cravings I get.
Let's go to Bill in Des Moines. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Just wanted Lisa's thoughts about the upcoming U.S. field and track event at Drake, how she feels about that, and approximate times that she's going to be running and what events she's going to be running in that event.
Okay, Bill, thank you. Let's just get a little can someone go on the web to find out more about what you're doing? Do you have a website? How do people find out where you'll be running in the future?
I guess the easiest way to do it now would be to look on cyclones.com. They will probably be coming out with statements about USAs and stuff. After that, I'm not sure. I'm still very new to this whole post-collegiate process. It's only been a few days since I finished NCAAs. But as for now, definitely cyclones.com. We'll have information about where I'll be racing for, where and when I'll be racing at USAs in Des Moines. I actually race on Thursday evening, Thursday evening.
Mm-hmm. How are you dealing with the celebrity that has been attached to this designation as the nation's top collegiate female athlete in long distance running?
I guess I never think of it as being a celebrity or being any more well-known than it was before. Maybe I'm oblivious, but distance running isn't something that's real mainstream. But, I mean, I've definitely had so much support in Ames and in Iowa, and people emailing me or stopping me and being like, you know, I've watched your career and you really impressed me. And it means a lot to me to have that support, and I don't think I would be where I'm at right now without it.
Mm-hmm. What about the Olympics are a few years away, but you got your mind on that?
Yeah, definitely. Next year is a world championship year, so I would try to qualify for the world championship team next year, and then the Olympic team in 2012, and I'll probably stick to the track, try to qualify in the 10K.
Mm-hmm. And what's the path to qualify in the 10K?
It's complicated, but basically you have to run a certain time. I'll probably try to run the time next year, an A standard time, which is 31:45. And
what is the split on that if that's a mile?
I'm not sure. I ran 31:18, and that was like a 5:02 per mile split or something.
5:02 per mile.
Yeah.
For many consecutive miles.
For 6.1.
Oh My goodness. Yeah. What are you listening to when you're boogieing along at that pace? You got an iPod?
I actually rarely listen to my iPod when I run. I really enjoy running. I really like just zoning out and having the quiet time to just be with myself and think and kind of, it sounds cheesy, but contemplate life and have that moment to myself. So I really don't listen to music when I run.
So picture yourself, 10 years into the future, you've got your doctor of veterinary medicine, I'm assuming?
Perhaps. I mean, running can, female distance runners usually, if you can have a long career, they peak in their lower 30s. And I'm only 22 right now, so I could still be running.
Okay, but eventually you'll get to helping more and more animals. I want to thank you very much for joining us, and really congratulations. We're all proud of you, Lisa.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Fort Dodge native Lisa Cole, she's been named the top collegiate female track and field athlete in the U.S., joining us by phone. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Lindsay Moon, Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christoph Mai. Technical support from Alex Hoyer as well today. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. I look forward to tomorrow's show. My guest tomorrow is Charlie Whitmack. He's the first Iowan, in fact, the only Iowan, I believe, still, to climb Mount Everest. In a couple weeks, Charlie Whitmack will embark on his latest adventure, an unprecedented 12,000-mile intercontinental triathlon that reaches from the frigid waters of the English Channel to the snow-covered summit of Mount Everest. At the same time, Whitmack and his team will be fulfilling global health and educational initiatives that originate in Des Moines. That's on tomorrow's program, my guest, Charlie Whitmack. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.